This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the attacks on 9/11, a lot of people wondered about sacrifice during a time of war. For the most part, we've only been asked to take our shoes off at the airport, but some have been asked a great deal more. Over the past 15 months, about 130,000 members of the National Guard and Reserves have been called up, some for duty here in the United States, others overseas. At the moment, about 60,000 are on duty, and you hear reports of additional units getting ready to head off to the Persian Gulf almost every day. What's the role and function of the Guard and Reserves today? Are they ready? How important are these citizen soldiers? What's it like to have to put your job and your life on hold, grab your uniform, and go? And what's it like to come home? Later in the program, John Burnett will join us to talk about the media boot camp that he and other reporters survived. But first, the Guard and Reserves. If you were or are a member, call and tell us your story and your concerns. We'd also like to hear from family members. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is our friend, retired General Major General Mike Davidson. He's a former Assistant Joint Chiefs, is on the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and was the Assistant Joint Chiefs Chairman for the National Guard. General Mike, good to have you back on the show.
Well, it's great to be back, Neil. Thanks.
First of all, we're going to be referring throughout this program the Guard and Reserves. What's the difference?
Not a lot, really. They're both good soldiers. The National Guard has a state mission as well as a federal mission, although almost all of its time and training go toward the federal mission. We also have an Air Guard and an Air Force Reserve that perform to this very high standard to the active duty Air Force as well.
The Guard is over 200 years old. How did it start?
It's actually over 300 years old because there was a colonial militia before we had a United States. It started because the colonists didn't want to bring an army with them from Europe. In fact, they were leaving the very concept of army and repressive governments. So they vested the defense of their communities in the citizens in that community, and that's still very much the concept behind the Guard and Reserve.
There has certainly been tension between the idea of standing army and militia almost ever since. Joining us now is Michael Dubler. He's the author of the newly published book, Civilian in Peace, Soldier in War, and coming out in February, The National Guard, an Illustrated History of American Citizen Soldiers. Mike Dubler, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil. How are you doing today?
Very well. Let's talk about some recent history. The tension between the Guard and the regular army, if you will, is how big is it?
Well, it's one of the fundamental things that's existed between the regular army and citizen soldiers, and it's varied from decade to decade, really. And the two main issues usually have to do with the regular army and the Air Force's degree of control over the Army Guard and the Air National Guard, and also the question of funding. Who is going to get the defense dollars, which are often precious, to finance those forces?
The National Guard has been credited with having one of the most effective political lobbies in the country.
You're right. The lobbying association for the National Guard is the National Guard Association of the United States. It was founded in 1878 and has been very effective in being an advocate for all Guard men and women.
General Davidson, as you know, during the Persian Gulf War, the National Guard, many of the units were upset. They felt that they were underutilized, that their combat units were cut out of the action, if you will. Have things changed?
Yes, they have. And you're right, there was a lot of tension during those years. But it's great to be associated with a part of the force whose driving goal is to get into combat. That's what you want your soldiers and airmen and sailors and Marines to be doing. So that spirit is not diminished, but some of the rough edges have come off over time.
You mentioned the Air National Guard. The Air Force couldn't go on a major deployment without its National Guard units.
No part of America's military, with the possible exception of a very small part of the Special Operations Force, can deploy without the Guard and Reserve. And that's probably the most important issue we'll talk about today. Creighton Abrams, when he was Chief of Staff of the United States Army in the mid-1970s, made a resolution that never again would we have a war like Vietnam, where America did not go to war, it sent its army. So Creighton Abrams restructured the active guard and reserve forces so that total force deployments were required. And that remains the policy today, and it's a good policy.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go first to Emily, who's with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I've called in because I had my husband now is in the Army Reserves, and we had a wedding scheduled for May of this year, and we made the decision last Monday after hearing from his commander Friday night that his unit was facing deployment. It was highly possible this month, and so we made the decision to go ahead and get married last Monday, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I've seen, you know, it's kind of funny because I watch the national news and I listen and I hear about, you know, wartime couples, and I realize, holy cow, this is my life. And we had planned, you know, to have this huge wedding in May with lots of family and friends, and it actually turned out to be a very intimate Monday at the courthouse. But once we got the news, all we wanted to do was be married. Hmm. And I had never thought about what it would be to be a military wife. He spent 5 years in the active duty as an officer and got out so that he could go to medical school. So I've only known him as a reserve officer. And to me, it was just extra money on the month. And now it is a very real part of our lives and has changed a lot of things for us in just the past week and a half.
What's the biggest change, do you think?
I would say probably there's just so much uncertainty in our lives. It's hard to plan. Like I said, he would be graduating from medical school this May, and we've been interviewing for residency programs, and there's just no guarantee about what the next 6 months to a year will hold. I think personally, it has made me feel very patriotic and very proud of him, and also very frightened that we would be spending time apart. We have a very strong relationship, and I don't fear so much for our relationship, just the impact that being apart will be on us. And I know I'm a one of a thousand couples out there right now, and I don't think that until your family faces deployment, you understand what an impact it is for families.
Yeah.
And I spent this past weekend, they had drill, and I got involved with the family support group, which will help when the unit leaves to support people, especially with children.
Yeah. General Davidson?
Emily, is he in that hospital unit out at Bowman Field in Louisville?
Yes, sir, he is. He's at the 50-10th.
It's a great unit. They've made a lot of contributions. And I think your call is important because we talk about sacrifices by the service member. The families probably make a greater sacrifice than the soldiers and sailors going off.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I feel that way because at this point I'm just doing what I have to do, and I look forward to helping other families, you know, and helping them really become support for each other. But I appreciate you knowing where we are, and I appreciate everything that the unit is doing for him as well.
Well, Emily, we wish you and your husband the best of luck.
Thank you so much. He's my new husband.
Congratulations again.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Now. General Davidson, we know what doctors are likely to be doing, but for the most part, what are the tasks to be assigned? What are these troops that are going to the Persian Gulf likely to be doing if there is a war with Iraq?
A full range of missions to include combat. We have two brigades in the Army National Guard that are mobilizing today. One of them is probably pretty cold up at Camp Atterbury, Indiana. The others down in Florida, but they're still training hard. So there'll be a combat mission for these guardsmen.
Mike Dubler, are they ready?
I believe that they are. Since the Persian Gulf War, the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard have put a lot of time and effort into improving the training and the readiness of their highest priority units, and I'm sure these units are going to be in the lead elements that are going to serve either stateside or overseas.
Let's go back to the phones. Josie joins us from Rockville, Maryland.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
My blessings go out to to Emily that called before. I know it's going to be hard for her. My son is in the National Guard in Maryland. On September 11th, he was at Fort Dix, New Jersey, getting ready to be shipped to Bosnia, and now and he spent until May, from September to May in Bosnia, and now we're facing deployment again to Iraq. So I have three things that I'd like to bring up. The first is, when he was sent to Bosnia, he was initially sent for 179 days, which is one day short of receiving active duty status. That means that he would not be eligible for VA benefits, even though he was being deployed into an active military situation. That's the first question. The second question is, there are stop losses in place now, and I don't know that people are aware of that.
Right. Stop loss means that if you're in the military and you can't leave, basically.
That's exactly right. And I think they're probably more widespread than is being reported. And I have to wonder why my son, who would be getting out in a year, is under a stop loss and actually having to serve time that maybe somebody else should be serving.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing is...
Well, why don't we deal with those two, and then we'll get back to the third one, if
okay.
we can. General Davidson, the 179-day rule?
She's absolutely right, and that's something that they've tried to eliminate. It used to be worse. There used to be greater disparities between guardsmen and reservists serving on active duty right next to an active duty soldier. I can tell you the Pentagon spent 5 or 6 years trying to eliminate those differences. There are still differences out there.
Why?
It's a bureaucratic situation and a budget situation, and it's not forgivable or pardonable, but there's still some lingering effects like that.
Josie, forgive me. I forgot your second question.
Well, can I just make a point about that? Is that somebody should be asking the question, how many of these deployments are for 179 days to go to Iraq? Because I, for one, would like to know that our National Guardsmen are going to receive VA benefits when they go to Iraq. So that's a real important question. The second question was on the stop losses.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they're relatively widely being used now. It includes not only National Guard, but it also includes regular Army. I believe more than one area of the military, Army and Navy, and possibly the other.
Yeah, go ahead.
And as well, it seems to be, I have been told that it's only certain professions within the Army. My son is a military policeman, but I think it goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Mike Dubler, do you know about that?
I know the Marines have implemented a stop loss, I believe just in the past week or so. There has been some discussion in the Army. Whether they have implemented it yet, I'm not sure. They may have already. I'm just not aware of it. But this gets to an important issue of how many people are available in the uniformed services to meet all the demands of the war on terrorism. And I believe that this is going to be a continuing debate going forward.
Mm-hmm. General Davidson?
The stop loss started after September 11th, and it was a blanket application. The Pentagon has since gone back and gotten a little more selective about the critical areas that we don't have other folks to rotate into.
Okay. And Josie, you had one other question?
The third question is, which you don't hear a lot of discussion about, but there's only going to be one MP unit left in Maryland after the deployment, after the most recent deployment.
Mm-hmm.
And
Josie, I'm going to put you on hold. We got to duck away for a break. We'll get this question after we get on the other side, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, hang with us. We're talking about the role of the National Guard and the reserves, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Give us a call or send us email if you've served in the National Guard or reserves. Were you ready for the work you had to do, and how was it when you came home? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the reserves of the National Guard and their roles in a possible war with Iraq. A little later in the program, we'll talk about the role of reporters in war and how they're getting ready if they should have to ship out. Our guests are retired Major General Mike Davidson, a former Assistant Joint Chiefs Chairman for the National Guard. Did they pick those titles to make them hard to pronounce?
Just on NPR.
Just on NPR. Also with us is Michael Dubler, author of the newly published book, Civilian in Peace, Soldier in War, and coming out in February, The National Guard, an Illustrated History of America's Citizen Soldier. You can join the discussion by giving us a phone call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And when we last left you, Josie from Rockville was on the line. You had one more question.
The third question I had is the composition of the MP unit in Maryland, and I suspect this is true in other places, is heavily firefighters and police officers. So as we send those units off, we deplete both our fire and our police department, which then leaves us with a critical shortage here at home. And so I have to wonder why we're using so many National Guardsmen when their duty really is to protect us at home.
Well, that's an interesting question. Mike Dubler, is obviously there are some certainly police departments and fire departments that we've read about already in trouble.
Well, Josie's on to an important question that's being debated right now, I think, in policy circles, and that is our first responders, our policemen, our firefighters, our emergency medical people have a spirit of volunteerism, which prompts them also to join the National Guard often. And a debate is going on about finding out exactly the numbers of people that are in our local communities on a daily basis and also serve in the National Guard. And this was really prompted by the response on 9/11 in New York when that realization occurred to the leadership. So this is something I know that's being looked at, and I think some analysis and decisions were made along those lines in the near future.
All right, Josie, good question. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. And can I just say, I love my son so much, and I don't want to see him deployed again. And so I would really like to see people volunteer for the Army and us not be at a point that we have to institute a draft.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Now let's go and talk with Dan, who's on the line with us from Reno, Nevada.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Afternoon.
I was a member of the Nevada Air Guard for 9 years, and there's a lot of misconceptions out there about the Guard and their mission, and one of them is that it was a haven for draft dodgers or people that wanted to avoid combat. And, you know, the Nevada unit was called up for 2 years during Vietnam. They were in the Gulf War, and some elements are currently, you know, on active duty. So, and you hear it a lot as it pertains to Bush, and if the general might correct me, but I think the Texas Air Guard was a part of Aerospace Defense Command, which was essentially a Cold War mission to protect the U.S. soil from Soviet bombers. And as such, they would have not been activated anyway. So,
that's absolutely correct. I think the president takes a bad rap when he gets accused of not being ready to go to war. Flying that Century series of aircraft, the 101s and all that, was a very, very challenging mission. So I take my hat off to anybody that will do it. I think that Reno unit was a RF-4 unit, wasn't it, Dan?
That's right. They had the 101s. They had the Voodoos when they were called up during the Vietnam era. They didn't go to Vietnam, but they did serve 2 years overseas. And then they had the RF-4s, and they were over in the Middle East there for a good chunk of time during the combat.
Okay. Yeah, tough mission. They don't have any draft dodgers flying those guys.
Neil, look, can I make a comment?
Go ahead, Mike.
Briefly, I want to assure your listeners and the caller that the National Guard of the 60s is no longer exists. The National Guard that we have today is much more highly trained. All the people are volunteers. They want to be there. And to draw any type of comparison between the two is really unfounded. And I think I agree with the caller that a lot of the American people are not aware of these changes, and the changes have been dramatic.
Dan,
and for the better.
Dan, are you out of the Guard now?
Yeah, I was in from 75 to 84, so I've been out for several years. My son is in he's in the Air Guard now. He just got back from his training, so
and
proud of him.
Yeah, you think he's likely to be headed out?
I don't know what they're going to do. They have C-130s now, so I'm not sure what's going to happen. But they have good guys. I mean, those guys will compete with the regular Air Force on any level, their maintenance, their flyers, their whole operation. They have ever since the days when they had the F-4s and the 101s, and they're still doing it.
Well, Dan, thanks very much. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Danny. And Danny's on the line with us from Stockton, California.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm currently in the National Guard, been in for 23 years, and we just came back from a deployment up to Fort Lewis, Washington for Noble Eagle. And one thing I noticed when we were up there is the standard of equipment that the active duty has opposed to what the Guard has. And I was wondering if if there's any time soon that the Guard will be able to train on the equipment that the active duty components have that we're going to be supporting.
Could you give us an example?
Well, let's take Singar Radial Systems. The unit that I have doesn't have any at this point. And I know they're making plans to change some of that if we get deployed. But it's it's a training factor that I think that I'm more concerned with.
Okay. General Davidson, this is an eternal problem, isn't it?
It is. We've been trying to get Singar's radios in the Guard and Reserve for 15 years that I know of. It's a budget issue. But Danny's absolutely right. That's a training hurdle, because when you get mobilized, if the first thing that you do is get a new suite of equipment, you have to go back and retrain on it.
Correct, yeah.
The only good news I can give you, Danny, is that some other folks faced that on a Bosnia deployment, and the Guard guys were smart enough to do the transition that was supposed to take 2 weeks in about a day and a half.
I've been in long enough to see a lot of things go down, and my unit, my battalion, have always been high speed, and if we're lacking in one small area of our training, it doesn't take us long to get up to speed. And actually, I think we surprise active duty units sometimes when we do that.
Danny, I can't help but hear what sounds like a kid in the background there.
I'm sorry, yeah.
That's all right. it just prompts me to ask, you know, when you're called away, when you're called up, whether it's to Fort Lewis or to the Persian Gulf, what's it like to pack up and then come home later?
The packing up is always hard whenever you get deployed, and this next one will possibly be my third deployment. I have a older son who is he's actually active duty right now and in the Gulf. So it might be a meeting of us if we get over there to Kuwait with each other. But it is always hard to leave the family. There's always concerns, and you know, if anything is Murphy's Law, if anything can go wrong, it'll happen while you're on a deployment. Coming home is always great. In Stockton alone, the support for troops here, I think, is phenomenal. Flags are still being flown everywhere, and it always makes you feel nice. Whenever I'm in uniform and I'm walking through, I get people that will say hi to me and wave at me and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that in itself is a lot better than probably what my father had to go through in Vietnam.
Sounds like you got an air raid alert going on over there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He's getting a little rambunctious on me.
Well, we'll let you go take care of it.
Okay.
Thanks, Danny, thank you very much, and good luck to you.
All right.
The digital age has come to the military, as it has to every other segment of society. This past June, the Senate passed the Science and Technology Emergency Mobilization Act, or NETGuard for short, which would call into service a group of rapid response volunteers that could restore communications and technology in the event of a terrorist attack. Joining us now is one of the sponsors of the bill, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, and he's with us from his office here in Washington, D.C., and good of you to speak with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
When did you first come up with this idea?
Well, after September 11th, and of course my state has a tremendous technology sector, we saw that when the terrorists struck, that telecommunications and all the information networks were flattened. You had landline and cellular communications hard hit by an incredible spike in volume, as well as strikes to the cell towers at the Trade Center, the Verizon hub, and a bunch of companies from my state wanted to help. They wanted to send people and equipment there, and they were just hindered by the fact that there was no infrastructure there to deal with them. In fact, some of them essentially testified to my Science and Technology Committee that they basically just stood around for a while until people could use them. And so we went forward with the NetGuard proposal, a sort of technology equivalent of the National Guard, and it became law last fall.
Well, who do you hope to recruit?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of volunteers with extensive technology expertise from the nation's private sector companies. You saw in my state the Intels of the world making clear that they'd be willing to move at a moment's notice when disaster strikes, and they'll help not just fix what's broken, but to create whatever technology systems are needed. And that could mean repairing and recreating compromised communication systems, setting up a command center, setting up a database, for example, to track the missing and injured. And now, under the Homeland Security legislation, these teams can organize locally and be ready to act before there's a crisis.
Would these people be wearing uniforms? Would they work in units together? I mean, you just have these ideas, this vision of people with pocket protectors marching down the street.
Well, it's interesting. Some of this has already begun to be developed on the local level. Actually, there are some parts of the country where people are already wearing hats and shirts and things like that. And what I'm struck by is if you approach this in a locally driven approach, what you will find is a lot of technology experts and entrepreneurs with a power and desire to help the country when communications systems have been shellacked as they were on September 11th. And you bet you can have these networks grown locally. We also envisage a national database of volunteers so that, for example, if a biochemical agent strikes in a particular area, health experts will know the people locally who are capable of dealing with it.
If somebody wanted to find out more, whether they're an individual or an IT company, maybe how would they?
Well, they can certainly call our office. We'll plug them in. That's my office, 224-5244 in Washington.
Submit the area code 202 before that.
202-224-5244. Probably faster is to call the Office of Homeland Security under the new department. That's the agency that's going to coordinate it. And right now they're moving to implement it. And our legislation has become law.
How big do you see this becoming?
Well, I think that there are an extraordinary number of companies and individuals who are prepared to help. We saw that after September 11th, and you're always reluctant to say the sky's the limit, but this is a sector made up of dedicated, patriotic, caring people, and they made it clear after September 11th that if the government will just take steps to ensure that their talent and energies are used, they are interested in being available.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for your interest.
Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, and he was speaking with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the reserves and the National Guard and the roles that they're being asked to play. And our guests are Major General Mike Davidson, retired, and Michael Dubler, who's written books about the National Guard. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go back to the phones, and our next caller is Robert, who's with us from Wallenau, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Germany.
Yes, you are.
Oh, good.
My name is Robert, and I'm a 15-year vet of the U.S. Army. I got out and stayed over here in Germany. I got into defense contracting. I'm a Gulf War vet and also was in I-4 in 96 mm-hmm. and had a lot of experience with reserves and National Guards. One of the things I would like to ask General Davidson is about, I've been hearing on AFN they're looking for liaison volunteers between German companies and reserve units over here. A lot of people don't know there is a large reserve contingency over here in Europe. And a lot of them are DOD civilians by day or in their regular jobs. A lot of them also work on the economy. And they don't have the same reemployment rights when they come back from a deployment as Guard or Reserve people do in the States. And I was wondering if General Davidson could give me some more information about maybe if they're renegotiating the Status of Forces Agreement to try and protect these people a little bit better, or what else is going on besides this program that I know they're having, or what it actually they're trying to accomplish with it.
The reemployment rights has been an issue, as you know, with German firms for a number of years, and you're absolutely on the right issue. It's going to take a renegotiation of the Status of Forces Agreement, which is essentially a treaty-level document between the United States and the German government. I have not seen a lot of willingness on the part of the previous administration, and that's not at all to criticize them, to reopen the Status of Forces over that issue. They made a decision not to do it. What the Bush administration will do on that, I have not any information, but it's an issue that'll have to be resolved over time.
Yeah, it's pretty critical. There's a lot of these guys that start to sweat every time something like this happens, and it's not right. You know, it's these guys do a job just like anybody else. They were talking about the German reserves. You know, they have their reemployment rights, but the Americans are kind of out there when it comes to that kind of stuff, and. It's a very hard, heavy issue with a lot of these guys. A lot of people don't go into the reserves for that reason. I know I didn't when I got out. And anyway.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Robert.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Here's an email we got from Fred Harms in St. Louis. I was mobilized for deployment to Desert Storm in 1990 with the only Army Reserve Black Hawk helicopter battalion to be sent to the Gulf. One of the most frustrating things we had to deal with was that after the war was concluded, active duty units were returned to the U.S. before many Guard and Reserve units, first in, first out. Many Reserve members had to give up jobs and money to serve with the unit and couldn't understand why they couldn't get back to their jobs at home. The feeling was the full-time job of the active component was to be in the Army. We'd all had other full-time jobs, but they insisted on keeping us in the Gulf for many months after the war was over. I was lucky because I worked for the government. I only lost about $5,000 serving in Desert Storm. Others lost much more. Michael Dubler, is this a continuing problem?
That's to be seen. One of the challenges the Army faced after Desert Storm was dealing with the massive amount of equipment and material that had been moved to the Gulf. That had to be taken out of the theater, put into storage, inventoried, and so on. And a lot of that job fell to the Army Reserve and the National Guard after hostilities were over.
We're going to stay with Michael Davidson and Michael Dubler for one or two more questions after the break and continue our conversation about the Guard and Reserve. Then we're going to switch subjects and talk with NPR's John Burnett, who just returned home to Texas after attending the military boot camp that was conducted at Fort Benning, Georgia. So stick around for that. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. So we'll return from a short break and talk to you then. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're going to continue now our discussion of the Guard and Reserve. Our guests are Mike Davidson, a retired Major General in the U.S. Army, former Assistant to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for National Guard, and Mike Dubler, who's the author of A Civilian in Peace, Soldier in War, and The National Guard and Illustrated History. And let's go to Jim, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello, Neil.
Hello.
Hi, this is Jim Cunningham. I'm commander of the Oregon Air National Guard out here in Oregon. It was nice to hear one of my senators talking on the phone. Special thanks to General Davidson for serving the country. I'd like to make one or two points that are that distinguish the Guard from the Reserve component just a little, and that is that the Guard, whether you are Army or Air, has a state mission as well as a federal mission. That makes us significantly different from the reserve component. The other thing is the gentleman that called in to speak about the president's service in the Texas Air National Guard and Air Defense Command during the Cold War era, that certainly has significantly changed. Air Defense Command no longer exists, and out here in Oregon we fly F-15s, and our primary mission in the Oregon Air National Guard as far as flying is concerned is air defense of the United States, but we have been deployed on many occasions to support Operation Provide Comfort, Noble Eagle, and And we are actively flying the no-fly zones, both in northern no-fly zone and the southern no-fly zone. One additional comment, and I think it has to do with the inability to receive training that is timely. I think this is primarily an Army National Guard issue. In most cases, their units have got to go to a national training center and spin up for combat for about 90 days before they're put into theater. Correct me if I'm wrong, General Davidson.
No, that's absolutely correct.
He says you're right.
Okay, great. We do give up a lot of time, especially the young kids. I certainly appreciate the comments of the gentleman from Germany who has a problem with getting employer support to the Guard and Reserve issues addressed. I do have a part-time job. I'm a captain for United Airlines, so since 9/11 last, the whole character of my service to the country has taken on a whole different meaning.
Hmm.
But out here in Oregon, and as well as across the country, you can bet that the Guard and Reserve is ready to go. The active component cannot do the job without us. Over 51% of the tactical airlift is in the Guard and Reserve, and over 52% of the tanker force is in the Guard and Reserve. 38% of the fighter force is in the Guard and Reserve, and 100% of the air defense is in the Guard.
Those were Guard pilots we saw flying over New York and Washington after 9/11 then.
Yes, they were. They were from Andrews Air Force Base. D.C. Guard flew those missions. And Otis Air Force Base up in Massachusetts flew over Boston and New York. And they can do the job on any given Sunday. They are on duty providing air defense alert for the United States 24/7 at the strategic locations around the country.
Well, thanks very much for calling in, and thanks very much for you know, doing what you do.
Well, thank you for the time, and I really enjoy your show.
Thank you. I wanted to finish up with an email question we got from Ben Slade in Cleveland Park here in Washington, D.C. I have friends in the reserves, he writes, are getting called up every few years now. This is different from years ago when reserves could go 15 years without getting called up. I've heard rumors that a few new reservists are signing up an existing reserve, that few new reservists are signing up. Existing reservists will not renew their reserve duty tours when the opportunity next presents itself. Are the reserves being overused as a result of the number of reservists in the future going to drop significantly? General Davidson?
It's an issue. It's an issue that folks have been aware of for several years. I can tell you that the recruiting is still strong, and there has not been a drop-off in either reenlistments or initial enlistments, but it's an issue that bears careful watching.
Michael Dubler, as you look ahead to this next chapter for the National Guard and Reserve, so what issues are you going to be looking at?
Well, I think the National Guard will fill at least two important roles in the war on terrorism. The first one will be defending the homeland. We've already seen several examples of that in the airport security mission, some of the augmentations that the Guard did to the Border Patrol, and also the great work the Guard did immediately after 9/11. The other mission, which is, I think, going to become more important in the coming months, is the Guard's participation in the overseas components of the war on terrorism, whether it's in the Persian Gulf or elsewhere.
Well, thanks very much to you both, and thanks, of course, to everybody who called in. Retired General Michael Davidson was here with us in Studio 3A. As always, good to speak with you.
Thank you, sir.
And Michael Dubler, author of the newly published book, Civilian in Peace, Soldier in War, and coming out in February, The National Guard, An Illustrated History of America's Citizen Soldier. Very good of you to join us today.
Thank you, Neil. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.